Welcome to The Road to Accountable AI. I'm Kevin Werbach, professor of legal studies and business ethics at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. For decades, I've studied emerging technologies from broadband to blockchain. Today, artificial intelligence promises to transform our world. But AI won't reach its potential without accountability, mechanisms to ensure it's deployed in responsible, safe, and trustworthy ways. On this podcast, I speak with the experts leading the charge for accountable AI. Azeem Asghar is the creator of Exponential View, a newsletter, podcast, and community that's one of my go-to resources on what he calls exponential technologies, which include AI and renewable energy. He's also the author of the book, The Exponential Age. He's an investor. He's the co-chair of the Global Futures Council on Complex Risks at the World Economic Forum and many other roles. Truly a smart guy. And someone, as you'll hear on the podcast, I've known for a very long time. I've always found Azeem to be one of the most perceptive people in explaining both technological trends and their larger societal implications. So it was a delight to speak with him today about the trajectory of AI, its challenges, its similarities and differences from earlier technologies, how companies are thinking about responsible AI, AI regulation, and the larger challenges of concentration in the tech sector. I'm sure you'll enjoy my conversation with Azeem Asghar. Azeem, welcome to the podcast.
Kevin, it's great to see you again. I think we're getting into our 25th year of knowing each other.
This is very frightening. And you've done a lot of different things, worked for various companies, started various companies. How do you explain to your parents what you do now?
Yeah, well, they're quite excited because my mum is now, my dad passed away last year, but he was even excited because I spend my time researching ideas on my own with my team. And I have a couple of academic affiliations, research them, thinking about the intersection between this rapid technology change, things like artificial intelligence and societal change from the economy to our legal institutions and systems of governance. And then I bundle that up, produce a newsletter from it, write the odd book, help the odd investor or company, maybe with a speech here or there. So I'm, a one-man band, but I do have an amazing team of researchers who work with me.
Yeah, it's one of those jobs that probably didn't exist before, but now you can be a real force multiplier, which is wonderful.
Yes.
Let me ask you, when did AI first come on your radar screen as a technology you should focus on? Obviously, AI has been around for a very long time.
Sure.
But at what point did you notice that there was something really important going on?
My first AI deal was done in 2001. So yes, it's been around for a long time, but then there was this additional shift because of deep learning. I first came across it in about 2012 or 2013 when someone in my team, my head of machine learning, wants to take a job at some funky London startup called DeepMind. I don't know if you've heard of them, and I persuaded him not to do that. And then when we sold my company, I had some time to think, and then I dug into things and I saw something was happening, and that was about 2014, so about a decade ago.
What's changed in terms of either fundamentally AI or how we think about AI today?
You know, the technology has really, really matured, and what happens in the process of maturation is things that become so hard. Only the very, very best researchers in the best research institutions can make sense of them. And then over the course of 4 or 5 years, they move to being available as an executive ed class for a couple of $1,000 at a business school, right? And that is how a technology deploys into the economy. So a lot of those things have happened with deep learning-based technologies, and traditional machine learning systems like classification and discrimination and so on. But the other thing that has happened, of course, is that the waves of discovery have continued. And alongside that, the underlying infrastructure, the enabling technologies have become much, much more capable. And that means that for a business, they need to have less expertise than perhaps they did a decade ago to get into these technologies. And they're supported, of course, by the systems integrators, the consultants who are the ones who really drive enterprise IT spending. And so what we see, which I think is pretty fascinating, is not just, you know, maturation of the technology that makes it more accessible to people, but also this continued drumbeat of absolute cutting edge breakthrough innovation, to the point that, you know, you and I have been in the tech industry for a while. It is very very sort of moments of Lenin. You know, decades are happening in weeks, sometimes in the same day. I mean, you finish reading one tweet and something else enormous has happened while you're reading those 200 odd characters.
But people in the tech world always like to say that this is the transformative time, this is the disruptive moment, this is the inflection point. Are we really at one of those points? What is it that makes you think that now it's really true?
We always say that because it's self-serving. And what's different, I think, this time is the, you know, let's look at a corporation. If you've got the C-suite, the C-suite are people who are likely in their mid-50s through to their early 60s, which means most of them have had careers using computers. And they've had computers on their desks, and they know how to use Excel. They probably did some time doing PowerPoint. And so they're much more computationally savvy than C-level execs, even when the iPhone came out. And they've had 20 or 30 years to digitize their businesses, which is what we've been telling them to do since forever. You know, we're out of that moment of J-curve that you see when you sort of have to implement new technology. So what that means is that companies are ready to deploy this. But let's then talk about the technology. So what happened with large language models was we turned computers into that scene. I think it's Star Trek 4 when they're trying to move the whales and Scotty picks up the mouse and says, computer, design me a da 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 da, right? We finally got there. We can talk language to computers and computers talk language back to us. And since humans essentially construct their entire world through the passing of messages in the form of language, that has allowed us to bring the capability of computers into those moments. And one of the things that is so beautiful about using something like ChatGPT is that in the old days, so November 2022, if you wanted to do a particular type of analysis, you had to configure that analysis into a way that a computer understood. So you took your mental model of the world, and that's why some people are good at programming and others are less good, because those people who can convert this sort of squishy human world into flawless logical code do so, and they do that translation. But now with ChatGPT, I can say, hey, listen, I kind of want you to do a MISI analysis on this list of issues, do it for me. And it comes back and it presents as well as a grad student, which is, I think, is pretty impressive. So I think those two things lend us to think that there are the ingredients for an inflection.
So my main focus in this podcast is on responsibility and accountability for AI. Let me just first ask you, generally, how do you think we're doing in those dimensions?
Can we mention that this is we're recording after the Google Gemini fracas,
I want to ask you about that. We will get to
okay.
that.
Okay, yes. So we'll get to that. I think we are doing, the awareness of the issue is much, much higher than it was 7 or 8 years ago. I mean, I remember in 2015, you know, writing about all these issues with Google Images and, you know, ML systems that couldn't recognize dark skin. And there were no teams. There was no discipline. There was not much academic study. We didn't do the kind of evaluations either a priori or ex post of the systems. And I think that has changed over the last, you know, seven or eight years. So that's worth paying attention to. You know, we in 2014, the reason these things weren't done was because people didn't know how to do them. No one really even thought to do them. And so the systems behaved the way they did. Now, after a lot of work by civil society, by academia, by activists. We do think about these things. And then the question is, of course, it's often embedded into sort of the belief systems and the narratives in the world at the right time, right? And just so I think that some of the things we've seen have been whatever the rung above the ladder, above the rung on the ladder above the idea of performativity is. So we're getting to that stage with some of this where people beat the responsibility drum really, really hard, perhaps harder than it needs to be beaten. I think Sundar Pichai at Google is somebody who does that a little bit more than perhaps he needs to.
Yeah, so let's talk about this example with Google Gemini, where for those who aren't familiar, they built an image generator model and a large language model, and addressing exactly those issues you're talking about, concerns about bias, went too far. That in some cases the image model would produce literally non-historically accurate pictures of right. people. The text model would just refuse to answer totally anodyne questions, saying they're too controversial. So people have different reactions to this. What's your takeaway or main takeaways from that incident?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, I think the absurdity of some of the outputs of Gemini can't be denied, right? So the idea that you might say, give me a picture of German soldiers from World War II, and it doesn't come back with them looking at all like that, how they should, or one I saw on Twitter recently, which said, who caused more deaths, Elon Musk's tweets or Adolf Hitler? And Gemini sort of prevaricates and ums and ahs and says it's an ambiguous question, which is just the sheer absurdity. So I think that it highlights two issues. The first issue is that large language models are very difficult to control. They are not like machines that we have built in the past. And so in the moment of trying to control them, you are choosing between helpful and harmless. And there seems to be right now in the methods that are used by these companies, really a trade-off between the two. But it's a bit more complicated than that, because you don't exactly know how much helpfulness you have to give up in order to make it harmless. And in a situation like that, I think you will always, use a bit British phrase here, over egg it, right? You'll always err on the side of caution in order to avoid the harmful nature of it. And then you sort of end up slightly in this absurdity. But I think there's a second issue, which is that, we have to recognize the world in which we currently live, not the one we want to live in. The world we live in is mediated by a small number of large technology companies. And that means that the AI they build will become our interface between us and the real world and the resources that we want to access. And so somebody has gone off and stuck this resource in between me and the world. I mean, you have to go to Gemini today, but in 2 years' time, everything you do on Google will be filtered through it. And they've gone off and made certain decisions, this harmless, helpless trade-off, other decisions in particular about what they consider harm. And to me, this is a public infrastructure, right? This is a public infrastructure. It's a utility. Maybe it's a type of good, public good. And Google did talk a little bit about what went wrong, but not into the degree of sufficient transparency of this new role they have of guarding something that is not purely a private asset. So I think that there are these two issues that we have to talk about and make sense of.
Okay, no, that's a good point. And that's I want to talk about the issue about the power of the intermediaries and the big tech companies. But let me just first push you a little bit more on the question about the capability of controlling the models. Your book was called is called Exponential Age, and you talked right. about how technologies like AI and renewables are on these exponential growth curves. Is there a concern that the improvements in the technology are an exponential curve, but our ability to control them are something like arithmetic? And I'm not just talking about here in terms of the broad kind of alignment that the AI doesn't kill us all when it becomes mm-hmm. super intelligent, but even on what seems like a fairly mundane problem yeah. like not having biased image generation, is that potentially an unsolvable problem?
So I think that this isn't a case of the type that I describe in my book. I mean, the ones I don't describe in my book are really about how the state and the institutions of the state and the people who comprise that are able to respond to this pace of change. I think what we're seeing in Google Gemini is much, much closer to what happened in the early years of jet-powered passenger planes. So these emerged in the early 1950s, and one of the first of those was made by a British company. We don't have names like this for jet aircraft companies anymore. De Havilland. It's so elegant. It's straight out of Downton Abbey. The De Havilland Comet. I think something in the order of 40 of these crashed. I mean, they make Boeing look like, you know, absolutely pristine, whiter than white safety record. And about 40 of these crashed. There were 20 of them had fatalities, and about 500 people died when these planes kept falling out of the sky. And the reason was that they had square windows, and the corners of the windows at jet speeds in the thinner atmosphere heated up much more, created lots more metal fatigue than they'd ever experienced in propeller planes that were on lower height and traveling more slowly. And they couldn't do, you know, they didn't have computational fluid dynamics, right, to simulate all these things. And we figured that out. And yes, 500 people died, and air travel is now so much safer. Now, I think that that's partly what we're dealing with within the world of the large language models, right, which is that these will be made safe in some way. They will become progressively safer. Now, not everyone agrees with me. There's an academic called Gary Marcus, who I think would take a different view to that and say that's kind of really hard, if not impossible, to make them safe, and they're poorly designed. But I think they can be made safe, and we will learn how to do it. Now, the challenge is that Google is in a race. It's in a race that is both strategic, that in some sense is almost existential, that is commercial, that is also about corporate and personal pride, which is driving them really fast. And we have constructed a world where we are looking for some hype to drink from as sort of consumers of the media. And so this pushes this process of actually figuring out how to make these things safe out into the limelight much, much faster. And so in some ways, I'm a little bit sanguine about the fact that this happened. I'm kind of annoyed. I feel it should have been caught in testing. But I think it is a case of this technology is, you know, it's 7 years now since the first academic paper. It's really early. And to be honestly, no harm was done, except for Google. Google is embarrassed. It shut the thing off. It'll figure out a fix. We won't see it. Is anyone really missing having an AI-based image generator for an extra few days? None of us are.
But won't that competitive dynamic you talk about continue? Because the company that has succeeded the most so far is OpenAI, partnered with Microsoft, which took the kind of Mark Zuckerberg move fast and break things approach. Well, Google waited to deploy its LLM because it was concerned about all of these issues. If that's always going to be the case, isn't there going to be constantly commercial pressure to push the envelope and not even to take the time to develop the solutions that are possible?
That's business. I mean, when we read the stories of what business people did over the last 100-150 years, I mean, they make trade-offs, and they have to apply their judgment, because, you know, nothing is perfect. No one has perfect resources. There are always competing needs, and there's also always ego and selfishness and profit motive in it. It's happening in a public space, which of course the business people behind them, and that's what they are. Let's not call them founders. Let's just call them business people. They're just like the greengrocer down the road. They benefit from the publicity that is being created by all of this, and they have to make difficult choices. I would say, having spoken to him a few times, but not knowing him because he's very hard to read, Sam Altman, I would say that Sam is extremely, probably very keen to make all his products factually accurate and, you know, generally pretty safe, not as safe as a, you know, nervous Nick might, you know, want, but pretty safe. But he's just waiting to for them to develop those capabilities. And he at that moment, he wants to go out and win market share. And what's happening is it's happening in this public domain with all the noise, by the way, Kevin, of this idea that these LLMs will crawl out of our fridge, like if you've seen the film Gremlins and you feed them and give them water and they turn really nasty, you know, like that, and take over our world, which again, I don't think they will. So I think we're in this funny stage where we should just kind of look at this and calm down a little bit. And in that calmness, it can still be a transformative technology. I mean, that can all be true at the same time.
One of the important things about this wave of technology is that we have these big platforms that are building the AI systems, but every company on earth probably is going to use them in one way or another, with some amount of either their own technology or just taking things off the shelf and deploying them. You talk to executives of a lot of companies about AI. How are they thinking about these questions of responsibility and accuracy? You know, what does it take to persuade them to make the right trade-offs?
I think in general, they take it very seriously, and it comes up surprisingly unprompted in the conversations that I have, and people talk about their responsible AI teams, or they'll say, well, we have to roll this out responsibly. I mean, there are some variations, and you know, for some it's a responsibility with a bit of a wave of a hand to say, don't talk to me about it. With others, it's more engaged. But I think that comes back to a little bit earlier in our discussion, where I said that the way things have moved over the last 7 or 8 years, it is that companies are taking this quite seriously. And perhaps, you know, the challenge is that how much of that is simply just lip service, and how much of it is really, really deeply embedded in what companies try to do. And of course, the thing is, Kevin, that how much do we want our companies to do? You know, the founder of the outdoor wear company, Patagonia, perhaps, is that?
Mm-hmm.
Who was sort of famous, he says, you know, business will always leave a footprint, right? And we can't pretend it won't. And our job is to try to make it as small as we can. And I don't think it's necessarily a company's job to act responsibly or act ethically. That is the job of, it's the job of the law and whatever is delegated to regulators to say, these are the parameters within which you should act. Now, you should act in that way and comply to this law. Otherwise, we're going to come in and find those breaches, and we are going to enforce actions against you. So, yes, I'm excited that CEOs care about it and they're not spending their time trying to figure out how to kind of wind their way out of their obligations. But I think it's a bigger issue that those obligations are not clear. They're not clearly defined, and so that the companies really know what the rules of the game are.
Yeah, that gets back to the point that you made earlier and you talk about in your book. Is there going to be enough capability in government to make those rules appropriately?
Well, I mean, government's getting better. It's definitely getting a lot better. And I think we tend to have a slightly sneery view of government, but we can go back to the first consumer privacy legislation, which came out in the early 1970s in California, on the basis of the arrival of computer databases. I mean, that is phenomenally far-sighted. I mean, if that person had gone off and said, computer databases are going to be huge, I'm going to build a company, they would be, you know, yachts aplenty by now. And in other areas, governments have been pretty impressive. I'll give you another example. My house was built in 1925. The cable that carries the electricity is rated at 100 amps and is still more than my house uses a century later. And we've got two electric cars and I have, like, you know, we've got all the electronics you might imagine. So governments can be far-sighted. The legislation and the rulemaking around genetic modifications in humans, right, was well ahead of the technology. But we have governments, I think, started to slow down for, you know, historical reasons. And you know, in my book, I talk about, you know, Reagan and the air traffic controllers and so on. But of course, that process of deregulation had started under Carter. And if you come at the back end of 25 or 30 years where the notion of good in the context, the intersection between government and business is about pulling regulations back, as opposed to recognizing that it is a presence of clear regulations, clear enforcement, a mandate for compliance that has allowed the pharmaceutical industry and the financial services industry to grow as big as they have. Of course, we're always going to feel that government is going to not have that capability. Now, I do think that they have really moved, and I can speak about the UK. I mean, the quality of people in policy, that is the civil service who will brief government on these issues, is really deep. Now, I just don't know if there are enough of them, but they're getting really quite good, and I wouldn't sort of besmirch them in any way. Our government, on the other hand, maybe that's for an offline discussion.
Fair enough. But with regard to AI, different governments are taking different approaches. And so you mentioned the UK. It seems that actually this is one set of issues where Brexit has actually made a pretty dramatic difference. On a lot of things, there's not a great deal of substantive difference between what's happening, you know, the laws in the UK and Europe. But
right,
the European Union has, you know, adopted, is in the final stages of this, you know, very extensive, very prescriptive AI Act. UK government, at least from my perspective, more like the U.S., has taken more of an approach of saying, let's look at what existing laws out there, let's try and figure out and you know, have different kinds of rules and how to balance innovation with regulation. Seems like a very different approach. So first of all, I guess, do you see that? And then, you know, what do you think is the best approach for governments to take?
I definitely do see that. And I certainly see that gap emerge. And there was something else that was about the sense of victory that was coming out of the various parts of the EU. And, you know, we haven't created a $100 billion company since SAP and now Novo Nordisk, right, which has got rich on Americans having an obesity problem, right? I mean, because they make semaglutide, the GLP-1 agonist. And so it's a really odd thing to celebrate. The other thing is, it's a really big act, and in a way, some parts of it may have been hurried, especially the bits that relate to the you know, large language models and those uses. But in reality, that has to now go through processes which will detail how things will get enforced. So we know that really bad laws can be created. I think, for example, many people probably view the Patriot Act, hastily put in place in the US after 9/11, as something that has resulted in some overreach and might need some paring back. But I think that the issue that I have with the EU Act is less about the specifics of the detail, but it was more about the posture of the participants towards this remarkable technology and what was really embedded within that, which was, I think, a bit of a distrust with American firms. But there wasn't within it a sense of, we'll create an alternative. And so then the question is, what actually happened over this period of time? So I think in these moments of really, really rapid change, you need to have principles-based approaches to regulation, right, rather than hard and fast rules. So I would say that's probably more a British style than an American approach. And you need that because the underlyings change so frequently. So I think that feels like it's sensible. But the other thing that I think will end up happening is that there will be an increasing harmonization of the ways in which nations look at certainly economic and industrial applications of AI. And the reason I think that they'll start to harmonize will be because we're in a search process of the what method works best. Will every country will benefit if it can access, if technology companies can access their markets on equal terms. So that will also start to drive some degree of consistency across the piece. Where I think it may differ will be, and this is probably going to be quite a large part of AI, to be honest, aspects that connect to culture, identity, or potentially national security issues, which was also the first sticking point, of course, with the internet, where countries sort of started to cleave themselves away.
But I think what we saw with privacy was that there was a lot of harmonization. So basically every global company is complying with the European GDPR, either because they have operations in Europe or because there's just no point in building two completely different systems. But I don't think anyone, even the people in the EU in the European Commission would say things are great on privacy, the practices have tremendously improved because we have this agreement on this comprehensive set of standards. So how do we get to a point where the actual substance improves, which, as you noted, companies, they want to hear government telling them what to do, but they have a role in helping governments understand what the capabilities are and what could happen.
I think a really great example of that was what happened with Apple and the App Store. So under the DMA, the Digital Markets Act regulation, because Apple operates this App Store that is sort of so big and so dominant, it has to provide alternative means of payment and alternative app stores. So if you're in the EU and you have an iPhone, this is going to be odd to your American listeners, you can kind of get apps from a different store run by someone else, and you don't have to pay through Apple. And of course, Apple has gone off and complied with this and involved something like writing 500 new APIs, which are kind of quite complex ways in which you use computer services over the internet. And they introduced new pricing mechanisms, because what they've done is they've absolutely complied to the letter of the law, as you'd expect, because they can afford good lawyers. And people are arguing they haven't complied to the spirit of the law. And this is the old problem of the sorcerer's apprentice, right? The Goethe, the old Goethe short story, right? Where we've got this technology, we try to control it, we give it rules, and it like follows them to the letter. So I think that raises issues about when and how is the right time to write these rules, and how do you get people sitting around the table at the same time. Now, I was actually quite a supporter of the Digital Markets Act, because my framing is that there is a tendency towards dominance in digital markets for reasons that I initially probably, Kevin, learned from you 25 years ago, and that force of gravity continues. And because there's this tendency to dominance, you will have concentration of power. So you need to find mechanisms to be more onerous with bigger firms than smaller ones, because the bigger ones are so much bigger. So I was, at a high level, I was a supporter of it. I think that the issue is, and there's another analyst called Benedict Evans, who I think probably made a better call on this than I did, where he said, well, look, the kind of the problem is that even if Apple is dominant, the process is safe and it's easy on the App Store, so consumers love it. So no consumer is going to go off the App Store to the dodgy flea market, with men in gray coats of saying, want to buy an app, when they can safely buy an app from the App Store. And that, I think, has a lot of momentum behind it as an idea. And that, I think, brings to bear the fundamental issues of capability within government, and who did you have the right sorts of people who really were able to have the right kind of dialogue to get around the problems of corporate capture, which is what we saw with GDPR, and have that conversation. And I don't think we did. So I mean, that's a that's a very long answer to say, you know, it's quite hard. I'm not sure it's necessarily going to serve European customers particularly well. I think what's hidden slightly below this is that these are all American companies. I mean, the rules are not written to discriminate against American companies, but it just so happens they're all American firms and will, you know, continue to be if what we do is celebrate passing laws rather than building companies.
One more question. You're pretty optimistic, it sounds like, both about the path of the technology, the business option, and working through these regulatory issues. What do you worry about? Where might you be wrong about any of these aspects that you think about? That's something that might put us on a bad path.
You know, that there are really interesting things that have happened that I wouldn't have predicted, like that a trained scientist running a major nation would shut down the nuclear program, as Angela Merkel did. I could run that tape 100 times. I would always say she's not going to do it, and she did. So I guess I get slightly concerned about the growing dominance of these firms. I mean, less so Nvidia. I mean, they're going off and making a lot of money because they're so far away from the customer. But the power and the capability that these companies will increasingly have, and then what that means in terms of their ability to control what's left of the public square, and to do so in ways that aren't really in the interests of the people who live there. And I think that we've seen some aspects of that play out with the way targeted advertising works in the US and you know, Facebook over not necessarily the last couple of years, but the years before that. I'm a very simple man. And so I simply go back to ideas of concentration of power wherever I see that processes and mechanisms that can reinforce concentration of power, it makes me nervous, because I can't believe that if you are that powerful, you aren't somehow skewing the rules or taking a kind of shifty vig on the side that we don't know about. So where I could be wrong is that we don't put in things that slow down this agglomeration. And the other workplace I could be really wrong is whether it's even possible to slow it down. So some days I wake up and I think, I'm just not sure it's possible to slow it down. It doesn't matter that Google and Apple are a bit scared of Lina Khan at the moment and aren't buying companies. I don't think it's going to slow down how quickly they grow. I could also be wrong about that. What I'm not worried about so much is I'm not worried about AI accelerating and getting out of control. And the reason I'm not is because I think we technologically co-evolve systems to keep it safe, even if we can't co-evolve the regulatory systems as quickly. But that's really about it. And of course, Kevin, I'm worried about the elections in the US and elsewhere. And I'm worried about, you know, what might happen with China and what might happen with Russia. I mean, those things are just background noise for 2024, really. They're the track to which we're going to be dancing.
Absolutely. No, a lot out there to worry about, a lot more that we can certainly talk about, but we're out of time at this point. Azim Asar, thank you so much. Always great to hear from you, and appreciate your sharing your perspectives with the road to accountable AI.
That's been wonderful, Kevin. Thank you so much.
This has been The Road to Accountable AI. If you like what you're hearing, please give us a good review and check out my Substack for more insights on AI accountability. Thank you for listening.